I'm joined in the studio right now by Scott Kennedy. He coordinates the Middle East program of the Resource Center for Nonviolence in Santa Cruz. He was elected to 3 terms on the Santa Cruz City Council and served twice as mayor. Kennedy was elected national chairman of the Fellowship of Reconciliation and founded and chaired the FOR's Middle East Task Force. He has traveled to the Middle East 4 dozen times since 1968, and most recently in November of 2006 when he co-led a delegation for the Interfaith Peace Builders. I'm also joined in the studio by Ken Carlson. He is a 30-year resident of Santa Cruz. He's a house remodeler, a UCSC graduate, and he's had a longtime interest in Middle East politics. And he was also on the delegation that we just mentioned. Again, a delegation of 14 members that went to Israel and Palestine last November for 2 weeks. And the name of that delegation, Olive Harvest Delegation. So you see that that was a part of what went on. I'm very pleased to be joined by both of you today in the studio. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you for the invitation.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
So maybe we could start off by some of the details, like how many people were in the delegation, who organized the trip, what the purpose of it was, what you hope to accomplish with this trip, and what organizations were involved in planning it.
Well, the Interfaith Peace Builders Program is a national program that takes at least 4 delegations every year to the region. And this year, for the first time, and I think it'll be a repeat experience, the delegation was co-sponsored by the American Friends Service Committee. And it was called an Olive Harvest Delegation because we were scheduled to spend a couple of days in 2 different parts of the West Bank helping with the Palestinian Harvest Delegation. We can talk about that in a minute. But the purpose of the Interfaith Peace Builders is to take people from the United States and other places, but mainly from the United States, to give them a firsthand impression of what's happening in the occupied territories and in Israel, the impacts of American foreign policy on the region. And what we find is that when people have actually been there and seen firsthand what's happening, they come back to the United States both more highly motivated to speak out and work on this issue and a little bit more credible to speak on the issues because they've seen with their own eyes and felt in their own bones the reality of what the occupation represents to the United States, Israel, and the Palestinians. So that's our main purpose, is to influence American foreign policy. And we find that even in relatively modest numbers, taking people there to see for themselves what's going on is a powerful motivating factor.
And there was 14 folks who went on this delegation, most of them from Santa Cruz, or were they from...
You know, the way the delegations shape up, like you might expect, the majority of people were from the two coasts. But this time we had a pretty good representation from the Midwest as well. So I would say roughly 1/3 the East Coast, 1/3 West Coast, and 1/3 in the center of the country. And one thing that our delegation program emphasizes is we try to have people from Muslim, Christian, and Jewish faith perspectives. Though you don't have to be necessarily a religious person or identified actively with any of those three faiths, we have leadership, shared leadership that always includes a Christian and Jew, or Jew and a Muslim, some combination, although probably 1/3 or half the delegation would be declined to state or independent. But we think it actually makes it a more rewarding and insightful experience for people to travel with a group and to reflect on different experiences they've had with people from different perspectives, because it gives them a deeper appreciation of the kinds of issues that arise.
We'll get into some of the detailed stories coming up in this hour, but just an overall kind of question for Ken. One of the purposes of the delegation, as Scott just said, is to educate American citizens about the region and deepen their understanding of the conflicts there. And I'm wondering if you felt that through going on this delegation that happened for you. Did you come home feeling like this was worthwhile and that you learned a lot from it?
Yeah, I think I learned a tremendous amount. I think that I'd done a lot of reading about the subject. It's something that, you know, I think has been so much a forefront in the news and so much a part of people who believe that if this problem were solved, we would have peace, the world would be a lot safer, we wouldn't have to fear things like 9/11. So, you know, we hear talk about a two-state solution, the West Bank and Gaza for the Palestinians and the remainder of the country for Israel. And so, you know, of course, what's the logical question I think a lot of people probably ask is why can't we seem to make a deal? Why is there not, you know, after 60 years, why hasn't there been, an ability to have a peace settlement so that there's two states and there's peace, two countries living side by side, a Palestine and Israel. And the news just seems like it keeps getting worse. And so I felt like going over there to see, like, where is Palestine? Is there, you know, is there a Palestine? Is there land for Palestine? I mean, does it seem like this is something that's forthcoming, or is there something else? And so I think that what I saw was what is talked about commonly in the United States as being where Palestine would be is all being settled. It's being taken over by Israel in terms of roads and basically just settlements.
So did you come home feeling more hopeless than before you went about the situation there, seeing as what you're saying about how the facts on the ground, actually seeing the settlement, like, the growing settlement building and the fact that Israel is continuing to take more and more of the occupied territories, that you came home, that you feel that this two-state solution that has been put forward for so long as the possible solution may not be possible anymore. Did you come home feeling less hopeful? Or
I came home feeling, well, actually, when I was there, I was feeling less hopeful. Much less hopeful. Really. Yeah. I just, it caused me to re-examine, the situation and also, you know, think that any solution is not only is it probably a long way off, but it's probably different than what everybody thinks it is.
Hmm. So what, did you feel when you were there, when you were seeing this on the ground, what did you feel as a U.S. citizen in terms of your feelings about the U.S. government's influence on that situation? And did you feel any confidence that after witnessing that you could maybe make a change back here in our government policy? Because it really does have so much of a role in what's happening there.
Well, I completely agree that the United States government subsidizes Israel so much, and in addition, you know, they're also subsidized by private contributions that approach $1 billion a year. I think that the occupation wouldn't survive if it wasn't for the contribution of the West. So, yes, the answer is we do play a huge role, and can I influence it? I'm only one person, but I sure am absolutely doing my best. I've talked to friends and relatives and anybody who's interested. I've actually been doing a lot of talking to people long before this trip, and I just believe that people need to be challenged that have certain belief systems.
And do you feel more confident now that you've been there in talking with people about the issue and in your own views and your arguments?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. I think that being able to explain firsthand not only what you know, because so many people get caught up in this one state solution, two state solution, binational state solution, on and on and on, and then they get caught up in who was offered what at Camp David and who turned down what, and what I come back with is saying, there's huge numbers of people, like a third to a half of the country. And when I say the country, I mean greater Israel, from the Jordan River to the Mediterranean Sea, that are suffering with no rights. They're living without human rights. And that, to me, is just wrong, just by definition, almost.
I want to ask Scott, what were some of the people that you met? What were some of the places that you went? I understand that these two-week trips, these delegations often have a very tightly packed schedule and that you do a lot of things. And I'd like you to run down some of the groups you met with, some of the individuals you met with, some of the places you went and the things you did.
Okay, I'll say just briefly that we meet with a range of Palestinian and Israeli groups. We especially focus on those that are working politically for a resolution to the conflict. So we meet with human rights groups like B'Tselem, which is the Israeli Information Center on Human Rights in the Occupied Territories, probably the most credible Israeli human rights group. We meet with groups like Combatants for Peace, which is a relatively new peace group formed by Palestinians and Israelis who've either served in the armed forces or been imprisoned for their political work. We met with high school and college age Israeli students, some of whom are active in military resistance. We meet with organizations like Sabil Liberation Theology Center, Palestinian Liberation Theology Center. But one thing that was different about this group, let me say also, those are mainly in the Jerusalem area. We make trips also to other parts of the country. We visited Haifa. We visited Bethlehem and Hebron. But the thing that distinguished this delegation from other ones is that we made two-day commitments to olive harvest in two different parts of the West Bank. The first was a place called Daher's Vineyard, which is about 300 acres of land west of Bethlehem. And they're a very interesting situation because they actually have legal title to their land dating back to the Turkish Empire or the rule of the Ottoman Turks. And they're now they're pressing a case to the Israeli High Court, trying to resist the attempt from three local nearby Jewish settlements from seizing their land. And one of the parts of their resistance strategy is to get Americans and other internationals to come to their land and spend time there helping to harvest. So we spent a night in Daher's Vineyard and helped to harvest. I hope we did more good than harm. But for the delegation, it was really a good experience to actually work with the land, with the trees, and a lot of informal interactions with the Palestinians, not to mention a freezing cold night sleeping on the hillside in Daher's Vineyard. Our second experience, we were supposed to work in olive harvest in the north part of the West Bank near Jenin. That proved to be interesting in another regard because we attempted on a Saturday afternoon three different checkpoints to enter Jenin from northern Israel, and all three times we were turned away by the Israeli soldiers that had all sorts of lame excuses about why we couldn't enter, bureaucratic reasons, and then ultimately it boils down, they say they're refusing to let us in for our own safety, even though it's an odd thing because, of course, you're leaving Israel going into Palestine, so they shouldn't be that concerned about why you're leaving their country. But in that case, we rearranged our schedule. We came back the next day, and we were able to enter. But sadly, we'd missed our opportunity to stay with Palestinian families and join in the olive harvest. But we were able to get a really good exposure to the Palestine Fair Trade Organization that organizes mostly small-scale family Palestinian farmers into co-ops. And they have a terrific fair trade organization and certified organic produce that they bring out of Palestine on a fair trade basis, everything from olive oil and olive oil soap to couscous and sun-dried tomatoes and wildflower seeds. And I think for all of us, it was really inspiring. Back to the earlier question about more or less hopeful. It's like working in the United States. If you're paying attention, it's incredibly depressing to see how things are going. But like in the United States, you meet Israelis and Palestinians who are courageous and imaginative and principled and fun. And how can you not be inspired by interaction with those people? So like running into the Nasser family that owns Daher's Vineyard, their generosity and their spirit. I remember one of the Palestinian men who is the spearhead of this attempt to save that land. He said, you know, we made a very early decision not to use revenge or anger as our response. We want to rise to a higher response than that. And that's why we're trying to focus on developing the land and bringing people from all nations. They call their operation the Ten of Nations. And so, too, in Jenin, of course, you know, the kind of daily frustrations that the Palestinians encounter, we had a small taste of that by not being able to get into Jenin. Then the next day when we're trying to leave Jenin, you know, we went to the border checkpoint, and there were Palestinian families there that had been waiting for 5 hours. Their loved ones who are in prisons have been moved inside Israel to prisons, which, of course, is a violation of the Geneva Conventions. And so for these families, when they want to visit their families in Palestinian prisoners, they have to go into Israel itself. And it's a huge problem. The fact that they have a family member in prison, in a sense, disqualifies them from entering Israel to visit their family members in prison. So in this case, the International Red Cross had arranged for a bus to come to pick them up at the border, but they'd been waiting for 4.5 to 5 hours at the border. Families, there's people were sleeping, kids were playing, people were fixing lunch, and we had to wait an hour and a half or something to get out of Jenin. It was just a small taste of what it is. Still, despite all of these frustrations, Nasser Abu Farha, who's the guy who's the main organizer of the Palestine Fair Trade Association, just to see the work that he does with the farmers. We went one evening to the Collective Olive Press to watch the farmers bring their olives in to be crushed and pressed into olive oil. And I think for all of us, it was one of the highlights of the trip. You know, you'd see guys who had like pickup trucks with trailers with maybe 40 or 50 kilo bags of olives. And another, I saw one Palestinian, he had like a half a 50 kilo bag of olives on the handlebars of his bike, a rickety old bike. And he's standing in line just like everybody else. And it's like a huge social event of all the families interacting. And we got to watch the whole process from crushing the grapes to the individual farmers also bring containers to take the oil. So anyway, that was a very high point. So that's the kind of experience the group is. We try to give people not just talking heads exposure, but also some experience on the ground. Like, for example, we spent a long day with the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions and PENGON, which is the Palestine Association of Environmental Organizations. And we spent a whole day visiting Jewish settlements and the separation barrier or apartheid wall around the city of Jerusalem. And I think as much as you study and as much as you try to comprehend what that's about, visiting these communities, seeing this wall being built right through the heart of Palestinian neighborhoods and dividing not just Israelis from Palestinians, but Palestinians from Palestinians, I think it's a kind of visceral, it's almost aesthetic recognition of what's going on that really stays with people.
What about some of the groups you met with, the Combatants for Peace, Women in Black, Israeli and Palestinian peace groups? And one of the folks you met with was the father of, I believe his daughter was killed in a suicide bombing, and he is a peace activist. I'm wondering about some of the individuals you met, what it was like to meet and talk with them. I mean, obviously you can't put every meeting you had and tell me all about that, but pick something out that really inspired you, and we'll go to Ken next.
I thought at B'Tselem, which is an Israeli peace group, I thought was very kind of highlighted some issues for me that I thought just needed some clarification, probably in my mind and, you know, maybe other people's too. And that is that what we're talking about is human rights. Like B'Tselem is not fighting for a two-state solution. They're not fighting for a one-state solution. They say that what they're fighting for is human rights. They're fighting for people, humans, basic human rights, and that the people that the, in other words, leave it to the politicians to decide how to do some type of final settlement, governmentally speaking, and that people like B'Tselem, when they were pulling the Jewish settlers out of Gaza, they were there to make sure that the Jewish settlers' rights were being protected. And like one person might think on an emotional level, especially if you were Palestinian, well, gee, what rights do these people have? They settled our land. They cleared out our farms. These people don't deserve any rights. But that's where she was real clear. It's like, no, they're human beings. They're living in these settlements, and they have right in this minute have rights. And that doesn't mean they have the right to stay there, but it has the rights to be treated humanely. And so that really, and actually the man who lost Rami, who lost his son, a daughter, I'm sorry, to a suicide bomber, said some of the same things. He actually deferred the political question to the politicians and talked about, rights and talked about people and talked about, let's stop this dehumanization of the other side.
Yeah, Rami El-Hanan, who Ken mentioned, His 13-year-old daughter, Smadar, was killed by a suicide bomber, a Palestinian suicide bomber, in the Ben Yehuda pedestrian mall in West Jerusalem. And he talks in very graphically about the horror that he experiences as a father or a parent when there's been a bombing and your child is out and unaccounted for, and how they went from hospital to hospital until finally they were referred to a morgue. And he says, you know, this kind of fickle finger of fate that you hope never will point to you, finally you find it resting on your forehead. And there's, he explains that, you know, after the period of mourning and all this stuff, that you have to make a fundamental decision. You know, is this going to turn your life towards one of hatred and seeking revenge, or something more powerful and something more constructive? And he talks about how he went through the process of choosing a different way to respond to his daughter's murder, to actually try to find some way to build a future for the peoples of this land. And it's a very powerful story. He talks about how a very tall man named Yitzhak Frankenthal came to his house during the period of mourning, and he's wearing a kippah and or a yarmulke on his head. And because Rami Haldan is explicitly secular in his worldview, he said, you know, he has kind of a bias or a stereotype of Orthodox religious Jewish people, that they're reactionary and narrow and so on. And so he was really put off. And this guy said, you know, you might want to come and meet with our group sometime. He really was offended that Frankenthal would come and presume to suggest to him how he would handle his loss and his grief. But on reflection, Rami Elhanan, in fact, went and connected with Frankenthal's group. And they have a very powerful movement called the Bereaved Families, or the Family Forum, or Parent Circle. And they have Israeli, several hundred Israeli and Palestinian families that work together to try to show that the failure of politicians to find a resolution to the problem between the two people doesn't justify the taking of human life, and doesn't mean that those people are doomed somehow to hate one another. So they've done some extraordinary programs. They have like a summer camp for children of families of who've lost loved ones, but they've done other things. For example, when there's a suicide bombing in Jerusalem, Palestinian families from the Bereaved Family Group came to the Jerusalem hospitals to give blood to the victims of the Palestinian bombings, and the Israeli Jewish families snuck into the West Bank to give blood to help save the lives of Palestinians who'd been shot or injured by Israeli soldiers. So they've done a lot of things. They think they have a telephone hotline called Shalom Salam, where anybody can call an 800 number. And if you're Palestinian, you can speak to an Israeli. If you're Israeli, you can speak to a Palestinian. They've had hundreds of thousands of people call. And they make something like 1,000 presentations a year in high schools, not only in Israel, but also in the West Bank of Palestine, where they bring Israeli and Palestinian family members who've lost loved ones in the conflict. And I think, you know, they say that they have a kind of credibility in Israel and Palestine, that if you've lost a loved one, people are more apt to listen to you and to give you a hearing. And they've had a very powerful impact. I know the Resource Center has brought two different speaking teams of Israelis and Palestinians from this group. And they speak in synagogues and high schools and colleges and churches, and have a powerful impact.
I'm speaking with Scott Kennedy and Ken Carlson. They were part of a 14-member delegation that went, interfaith delegation that went to Israel and Palestine last November for 2 weeks. Scott Kennedy was one of the co-leaders of that delegation, and Ken Carlson, a local here in Santa Cruz and a house remodeler here, was one of the people who went on that trip as well. I want to go back to, you mentioned that you had gone to, one of your first visits was to a farm, the Nasser family farm, that's surrounded by three settlements. It's just west of Bethlehem. And I was wondering if you could go into a little bit more detail about that farm. I understand that you did some olive harvest while you were there. But I'm curious, you said that they're in litigation right now to defend their land. Can you give a little more background on that? Because I think it's an interesting case example of what Palestinians are facing with their land under threat, etc.
Well, the situation, they call their land Daher's Vineyard. They have olive trees and grape vineyards and other crops besides. It's typical in some ways, and it's very atypical in other ways. It's very typical in the sense that there are three Jewish settlements on hilltops in the area surrounding Daher's Vineyard. When we drive to that place, we drive on Route 60, which is one of the settlers' main roads north-south on the West Bank. Then we turn off. It's very interesting. We stopped and took photos because people immediately notice the difference. There's a well-paved two-lane road that goes to one of the settlements called Neve David. And then right next to it is a one lane, used to be asphalted, now very potholed, damaged road, which you take to get to Daher's Vineyard and the other Arab villages in the area. We drove about three quarters of the way to Daher's Vineyard, and then the road is completely obstructed by huge concrete or stone rocks that were probably like 6 feet by 6 feet in dimension, cubes, blocking the road. So that we had to get out of the bus and walk, which was no big deal, but it was interesting. There were cars parked on the other side of the blockade. These were Palestinians who drive to the blockade, get out, and then walk. They actually work in the Jewish settlement, Neve David, but they have to walk. And in terms of security, there's nobody there staffing that blockade or anything. It's just an inconvenience and a pain in the neck for everybody. Anyway, that's an opening scene of this land. They say that I've heard that something like 10% of Palestinians actually hold legal title to their land. That's because, of course, under the Ottoman Turks for 400 years and then the British Empire during the mandatory period of several decades, they didn't have any kind of formal landholding provisions like we have in the United States or that we would expect in a land dispute here. So much of their land, especially if it goes unharvested, under Turkish law, if land went unharvested for 7 years, I think it is, then it reverted back to what they called state land, which was held by, let's say, the Waqf, which is the Muslim public land authority. Well, Israel has said that in continuity of that authority, land that's not farmed, actively farmed, reverts to being state land, which in their case means Israeli state land. And they take the land, they feel lawfully that they can take the land from the Palestinians. Some cases, Palestinians have worked that land and paid taxes for it for generations or decades. But the fact that they don't own legal title makes it very difficult for them to hold on to the land. Sometimes the Israelis publish a notice that they're planning to take the land, but they publish the notice, legally required public notice, in a Hebrew language newspaper. And nobody on the Palestinian side of the question even knows that it's happening. And then maybe that's published like in the 1970s or 1980s, and 15 years, 20 years later, when the Israeli bulldozers arrive, they suddenly discover their land has been formally taken by the state, and they didn't even know it was happening. Of course, they've lost any chance to appeal. That happens a lot to Palestinians, and if the argument about it becoming state land doesn't work, of course, Israel... like in the United States, if they declare it's a national security matter, they can take any land they want just in the name of national security. The unusual thing about the Daher's Vineyard is that the Nasser family, as I said, actually holds legal title. They don't only have tax receipts from all the administrations dating back to the Turkish Empire in 1917, but they actually have legal title to the land. So they have waged up till now. It hasn't proven successful, but they've gone all the way to the equivalent of the Israeli Supreme Court. And when we were there, they had just spent, I think it was $10,000 to have still another land survey done. And they'd had to have investigators go to Constantinople or Istanbul to go through the court records to show that they own legal title. So they've spent, I don't know if it was $100,000 in legal expenses, but they feel it's so important when there's an opportunity, even though they only own, I think they only have title to 100, they farm 300, but there are hundreds of other acres of land surrounding them by other Palestinian families. So they feel like they're kind of a wedge, that if they're able to successfully defend their land, then the others will have a greater chance of defending their land.
And one other thing, too, is that the power, not only is Israel blocked off the driveway, so you literally can't drive up to the property. You have to park your car maybe a half a mile and walk. But they've also shut the power off and shut the water off. So they've had to dig their own well, and they have to have a generator up there that they have to start And in addition, after they spent this money on the survey, Israelis were saying that they needed to spend even more money to do some type of other survey that's much more expensive, and then they needed to get all the neighbors to sign to agree to that, which and
basically so, making them jump through 1,000 hoops that are very expensive hoops that most Palestinians could not possibly jump through. I'm wondering how they got the money to even pay for all this stuff they were required, $100,000. I mean, was this, did they have to do fundraising to
come
up with?
Yeah, they get support internationally. They get some support legally, though they have to pay for lawyers. But I think the extended family just considers this absolutely imperative to try to save this land.
I'm wondering, Ken, how you felt staying there at the Nasser family farm. Again, it's just west of Bethlehem. It's surrounded on three sides by settlements. And you said the road's blocked, the water's been, you know, cut off, the electricity's been cut off. You look around, I'm sure, at night and see the well-lit settlements nearby. They definitely have water. There's no question about that. How did you feel being there in the situation that...
It was very hard. I mean, I was extremely impressed with the hope that the Nasser family had that they would be able to save their land. And at the same time, I looked at their houses and their property as two Israeli bulldozers could eliminate all of those houses within, an hour. It would just all be gone. And I just felt like that would happen when Israel feels like nobody's looking, or they feel like there's a lull in the support for the Nasser family, or just whenever they've got 24/7, they can do whatever they want. And it's just one piece of land. And if you were there, you'd see these three settlements. I mean, they're huge settlements. They're not city size, but there's probably, their townhouse style is how the Israeli settlements are. And they look very similar all throughout the whole country. There's probably, 200, 300 houses, or townhouses, I should say, in each one. And you can see the construction is going on. I mean, it goes on until late at night. You can see the dust clouds. And then the interesting thing is there's Daoud's farm, and then below it, kind of between one of the settlements and this piece of land of the Nasser family, is an actual Palestinian village that's maybe, got, 100 houses or something. And it, at night, the lights in the Palestinian village are flickering, and they're all fluorescent. And the settlements are all these beautiful silver iodide lights shining real bright. And these lights are dim, and you could tell you could have trouble even reading, by these lights. But these Palestinian villages are running on power that's just, just the absolute minimum. So, I mean, not only is Daoud's farm in peril, but so is this Palestinian village.
What about travel, Scott? You were mentioning earlier some of the checkpoint, the situation when you tried to get into Jenin. You were supposed to stay in Palestinian family homes and participate in the olive harvest. Ultimately, you were able to at least meet with the Palestine Fair Trade Organization, but you had your plans thrown off and weren't able to stay in the family homes and such.
Generally, we were able to travel everywhere we wanted to go. Because we're Americans, in this case, all American citizens, and we had American passports with us, you're able to go in and out still, really without too much trouble. I've been there when we were denied permission totally to go in. But in this case, and it's so arbitrary, it depends on the circumstance, that what's happening that day politically, and the mood of the individual soldier or the commander of a particular area. In this case, we really were able to move pretty freely, except for the day we were trying to get into Jenin. That happened to be on the Saturday, even though it was open, it is the Sabbath, they're understaffed, and we don't know all that went into that. But generally, with an American passport, you're able to go back and forth from Israel to Palestine. One huge difference, and this is really hard to appreciate from Santa Cruz, is what's happening with the separation barrier or the apartheid wall that's being built. With the apartheid wall, for example, completely surrounding Jerusalem, now where there used to be dozens of checkpoints on roads going in and out of Jerusalem, it's being consolidated into a half dozen or two or three major transit points, which are like crossing an international boundary, where you go through, and we did this probably a dozen different times going from different parts of the West Bank in and out of different parts of Israel. And you pass through a series of turnstiles, big metal turnstiles, and you don't actually even encounter an Israeli in person for security reasons. It's all done by remote control. It has kind of a, in some ways it's better, but in other ways, because the checkpoints used to be just terrible. You're standing outside in the dust or the heat or the cold and the wind. Now it's indoors, it's all formalized, but it has a very bizarre feeling to it because it's so impersonal. But we understand from, you know, the Israeli concern about security, but it makes it much more difficult when the separation barrier is done, when the wall is being built through most of the cities, it will become much more difficult to go back and forth. And of course, for us, it's a minor inconvenience. For Palestinians, it's devastating, and it's separating. I just want to mention, you know, in Jimmy Carter's book, he says that anybody who wants to try to understand what's going on there should see this film, The Iron Wall. And we're showing it a half dozen times in the future, 2 weeks at, from the Resource Center for Nonviolence. And I really hope if people pick up The Good Times this Thursday, coming Thursday, there's going to be a full-page ad that lists the times and places, so I won't list them now. Or you can go to the Resource Center's website, rcnv.org.
Mm-hmm.
But the point I'm trying to make is it's really hard to visualize what it means to have a 25-foot wall going through the heart of your town. But it's going to make the passage back and forth very difficult. Now, Israel has announced that they're imposing a new policy that will require anybody visiting Israel, and you can only enter through Israel. When you enter, if you're going to go into the West Bank, you will have to have a special visa to be able to go into the West Bank. Now, you know, periodically the Israelis send up these little trial balloons to, with some outrageous notion to see if it's accepted. This has provoked quite a controversy. I don't know if it's going to be implemented. But theoretically, they could make it essentially impossible for us to enter the occupied territories, the West Bank, just like it is. It's almost impossible to enter the Gaza Strip because they have this regimen in place, and they're talking about putting the same situation in place in the West Bank, which would mean it's impossible to go from Jerusalem into the West Bank to go to Ramallah or Nablus or Jericho or Bethlehem.
And why do you think they're doing that? Why do you think the Israeli government is doing this? Is it to keep internationals, Americans, whose tax dollars are funding all this, to from seeing it?
I don't see any rationale. You know, when I was in Gaza Strip for a few days after the delegation, I don't see any valid security rationale. I agree with Jeff Halper from the Israeli Committee Against House Demolition, an Israeli Jewish university professor who says, you know, this is the age-old Israeli principle of taking as much land as possible and as few of the Palestinians as possible. So it's a process of separation or isolation of the Palestinians. And it's a subtle, or not too subtle, but systematic form of ethnic cleansing where over time, life becomes so unbearable or so unsustainable that increasing number of Palestinians are finding it there's no other alternative than to leave if they're able to. So I think it's part of a, like I said, a policy more subtle than what we've seen in other areas, but no less effective, of gradual ethnic cleansing over a period of time.
I read the reports that were sent by your group when you were on the delegation in Israel and Palestine. One of the stories that really affected me that I remember was one about meeting with rabbis for human rights. Meeting with a rabbi from the group Rabbis for Human Rights, and I'm wondering if either one of you wants to talk about that meeting and what he had to say.
I would say that he focused on helping Palestinians save their houses. I think his focus was more on trying to stop house demolitions.
We met with the executive director, whose name is Arik Asherman. It's interesting. Rabbis for Human Rights, they have representatives, rabbis from all the main Jewish traditions: Orthodox, Conservative, and Reformed. And one thing that I find interesting about their work is they're not only opposed to the Israeli occupation because they think it's in blatant contradiction of Jewish values as they understand them, but they also struggle for social justice within the state of Israel. So, for example, they have a major campaign now, Stop the Wisconsin Plan, because there's an attempt to impose or to bring into Israel the kind of neoconservative economics that Netanyahu really likes and borrowed from the United States. And as a result, in addition to the war going on with the Palestinians and the terrible situation of the occupation, for example, the income gap in Israel is more and more stratified, and the incidence of poverty and malnutrition among seniors and children in Israel is growing dramatically. So the rabbis also have a domestic justice component that we don't hear much about here, but it's really important because they're looking at life whole cloth and the way Jewish values should be brought to bear. It's the kind of thing you wish in the United States we were hearing more religious Jewish leadership. You have Rabbi Michael Lerner and Arthur Waskow. You have a handful of progressive rabbis who are speaking out on these issues, but we don't hear very much about it, and that's one thing that was very impressive. And Ari Kashman, let me just say, one of his really powerful stories is he tells when he was he rushed to a Israeli jeep because he had been told a Palestinian was being a boy was being held there, and it was a situation, I think, Olive Harvest or Home Demolition, and they were beating this the Israeli soldiers were beating this Palestinian boy. He came up, tried to intervene. He was slammed against the jeep, handcuffed and taken away. Later, Beth Salem came to take the affidavit from this boy about what happened. And he tells a story, and then he ends the story by saying, and then this tall man with a kippah came and saved my life. And Arik says that all of his work was made worthwhile by that one statement, that there are Palestinian children who understand that there are Jewish people who will stand against injustice and how important that is.
I've been speaking with Scott Kennedy. That was him just speaking there. He coordinates the Middle East program of the Resource Center for Nonviolence here in Santa Cruz. And he's also was elected national chairman of the Fellowship of Reconciliation. He has traveled to the Mideast 4 dozen times since 1968, and most recently in November 2006 when he co-led a delegation for the Interfaith Peace Builders. Also, Ken Carlson in the studio with us, 30-year resident of Santa Cruz. He's a house remodeler here and has a long-time interest in Middle East politics. He also graduated from UCSC. And we have to wrap up, Ken and Scott, here. I want to give you both an opportunity to make a couple of, you know, final comments. And in that, you can also include, you know, what resources for people to follow up on this and, you know, check out some of the Resource Center events or good websites you think people might turn to. And maybe we'll start with you, Ken.
Well, I want to thank you very much for having me on this program.
Of course.
I really think that people need to understand that the land that when you hear people, politicians especially, like the Bush administration, talk about a two-state solution, the very land that would be a Palestinian state is the land, such as Dawood's farm, that is being cleansed of Palestinians by the Israeli government. So this is not in Israel proper. This isn't anywhere. This is in the Palestinian territories. And if you just look at a map of Israel, just a tourist map, you will see highways, you know, Highway 6, Highway 3, just like Santa Cruz, just like the United States. But what you don't realize is those maps are maps of Israeli settler-only roads, and these are in Palestine. So the Palestinian land is being taken over by Israel so that you're left with just no other explanation but apartheid, because the Palestinians are all completely contained within greater Israel. And so we're left with talking about how do we talk about human rights. I mean, we have 3.5 million people living. They live under military occupation. They have no right to vote. They can't even drive their cars on the road that's right in front. Imagine not being able to drive on Bay Street or Soquel Drive without a special permit. I mean, it's just over the top. So anything anybody can do, there's all kinds of websites. Scott, I think, can probably help with that a little bit more. But thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Ken.
Well, in the interest of time, I'll just refer people to the Resource Center's website, because we have links to a lot of the peace and human rights groups. Our website is www.rcnv.org. And you can go there for openers, including links to the recent delegation reports from that Ken and I were part of. The other thing I want to mention, in the coming week, on the next two Thursdays in the Good Times and next Sunday in the Santa Cruz Sentinel, there are going to be full-page ads announcing a whole series of screenings of The Iron Wall. And this is an excellent film to understand more clearly what's happening in the West Bank and why some people are saying the possibility of a two-state solution is dead and it was killed by Israel. That's the sober message that Jimmy Carter's book has been giving. It's something that people here really don't want to hear, but it's really important that people understand. Get past the title of Carter's book and actually read the book. The Resource Center is selling it at cost. So you can contact the Resource Center for Nonviolence, 423-1626, for information about the film screenings and the availability of the book at cost.
So again, Resource Center for Nonviolence website is rcnv.org. You can read the reports from the delegation, the interfaith delegation that both Scott and Ken were a part of for 2 weeks last November. And you just go to RCNV and click on the calendar if you want to see their calendar of events, or pick up the Good Times this coming week for a full page ad. I want to mention, so other than RCNV.org, you can also check out the organizations that helped to put on these delegations. One of them is the Interfaith Peace Builders. Their website is interfaithpeacebuilders.org. And also the American Friends Service Committee, their website is afsc.org for the American Friends Service Committee, afsc.org. Thanks again to you both so much.
Thanks so much for having us.
For coming in.
Thank you.
And this is Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.1 FM, streaming online at freakradio.org.